everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Wonder Podcast, the podcast where we break down and review films all in one big, long, unbroken take. I'm Austin Archer, and with me, as always, is my childhood next-door neighbor, lifelong best friend,
Kramer England.
Ooh, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. And just like, yeah,
Hey, I'm going to say right off the bat, Michael Giacchino kills it in this score.
Oh, yeah.
This, I mean, they're all good, you know, but this score, Michael Giacchino, okay. So at work, we have some people from the industry. At my work, we have some people from the industry come in and talk to students. And we had someone who is a composer come in, and he was talking about just, you know, nobody does themes anymore. Like, you can't really hum themes to a lot of, you know, but Michael Giacchino, he's one and that, you know, you're listening to one of his scores.
For sure. And obviously the Mission Impossible theme is built in to any score. We are talking today about Mission Impossible 3, the J.J. Abrams Mission Impossible movie. That's the that's the one we're talking about. But obviously, it's Mission Impossible time in the world. Yeah. The new Mission Impossible movie is coming out, possibly the last Mission. You know, who knows?
We'll see. Yeah.
Yeah. But Michael Giacchino, this is when he came into the franchise as like the, you know, the kind of like arranger, but this is also where we get a lot of themes that have stayed in the series.
Yeah.
You know, the love theme for him and, you know, him and Julia that kind of comes back in different phases. Mm-hmm. You hear a similar theme with him and Rebecca Ferguson, if I'm not mistaken, in other episodes.
Yeah.
And then also, like, there's kind of like a theme that is like the theme of his team, of like the Ving Rhames and Simon Pegg team that I feel like Giacchino debuts in this movie. And
there's a lot that seems to be taken from this point on. They get so much more consistent from three on. I mean, they're still a little like teetering with three and four, kind of like teeter on the edge. 5, 6, 7, and 8 are obviously all very connected, and then they kind of, but it all kind of seemed to start with three. Like, this is where it really started to find its groove.
Well, you know, like, first of all, I just want to generally say about this franchise that, like, it's really a pretty smooth franchise. It's a pretty ride. We got like generally, I feel like people feel like there's one hiccup and it's movie two.
And
some people weirdly don't like movie three. I've heard that a lot before, that people like feel like movie three is a misfire and that it doesn't really get back on track until Christopher McQuarrie comes in, that there's elements of Brad Bird's movie that they like, but Christopher McQuarrie's like, he's had the best era, and everyone obviously likes the first one because the first one has a really, really nice tone to it. Yeah. But I think all that really, I mean, I remember seeing this movie, Mission Impossible 3, in the theaters. And at the time, it felt like a massive course correction, but it also felt like it could have been a capstone to a perfectly fine trilogy.
Yes.
It felt like it was like they made this first movie that was very popular with critics and audiences and very commercially successful. They came back with John Woo and took a big stylistic swing. And it's a very tonally different film in the second movie.
Yes.
And it was very divisive with audiences and critics. And then it almost felt like the franchise might be dead because of that divisive response to two. And then when this movie came back, to me at least, it was like, oh, they're making another one. And the movie almost feels like it's going like, Ethan's done being a spy, but he's back for one more mission. He gets pulled back into the field for one last thing. And that's how this movie story-wise feels, and also in the franchise at the time felt. But I think the movie was so good at reconnecting the tone of what this franchise should be that it kind of gave it new life. And I do think that, like, everything that's come since has borrowed from the tone of three.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. It seems like this kind of started because I totally agree. It was like, okay, this will be the end. Like, that's fine. And then it kind of, then they came out with four, and it was like, well, how is this going to be? And people still loved it. And then they kept doing it. And it was like, yeah, these are great. If it's going to be good, keep going. But it all really did start with three. It was like, that's kind of like, oh, this series has legs. Like, it can keep going, and it can keep going because things can change, and it keeps you more interested, and they got more, they've got more consistent with the stories. Like it blows my mind. Like this is when Benji comes in.
Yeah.
It blows my mind. Simon Pegg is in two scenes, basically like two and a half. Mm-hmm. And everybody loved him so much that he stayed the entire rest of the series.
He gives the movie, and it's weird too, because like you've got Jonathan Rhys-Meyers there, and you've got, what's her name?
Maggie Q
there, who are both doing really great work in this movie. And I don't know why they just get left behind and we never get to see them ever again. Well, also Lawrence Fishburne. I feel like that happens a lot in this franchise though, is like director guy, whoever the director is like always
die.
Yeah. It's like, it's always someone else. It's always, you know, but I kind of am mad that Larry Fishburne only got this one movie, because I think he's really fun in this movie.
I think he is too. I actually would have loved to have seen him in more of them. Well, and it's weird. Anthony Hopkins, he was one of the directors or something.
Anthony Hopkins was in movie too.
Yeah. It's so weird. The people. And then, you know, that position is weird. I don't know why they didn't bring back Paula Patton. Like, I liked her character too, but they just kind of have these side characters that kind of are left in the dust. But Benji Dunn, he's a scientist. Like he's like a data scientist or whatever. And then in four, they're like, everybody loved him. Let's just pretend he passed his field exam and now he's in the field. And like,
which is, by the way, crazy.
It's sense.
It's actually insane that Benji passed a field exam and is in the field, because one thing that three sets up, especially when you watch three, it shows that. So Ethan Hunt is retired from active duty. He's no longer a field agent.
Yeah.
When movie three begins, we're not actually getting into the plot yet because we haven't done the first scene yet.
But
he's training field agents. And one of the plot points is that he never recommends a single student for active duty except for Kerry Russell. And it really shows like how specific and stringent, you know, and also like we've just seen over the course of the series, like what it takes to be a field agent for the IMF. And somehow Benji is out, you know, and I guess maybe if they're like, you can have this very specific role as like a tech guy, but in four, he's like in the field with Ethan and Jeremy Renner. And he's like out there doing stuff.
And he has combat training. Like he fights people and like he did, but I think it is the only way that I'm on board with it is like, he's always doing the tech stuff. Because they always have things that they need to do. So it's like, okay, he's good enough to shoot a gun and like help when needed, but he's there for all the tech stuff. So,
you know what's crazy is I thought watching three, I was like, oh, I guess the only two people that are in every single movie are Tom Cruise and Ving Rhames. Ving Rhames isn't in four.
He is in the very end.
Okay.
He's in the very end. Hey, like, good job. Like, you saved the world. And then it's like the last scene. But so I guess
but it's crazy that he's not like part of it.
I know it is kind of weird, but like he's at the end when they're like all talking and he like Tom Cruise and him.
Did Brad Bird just not like Ving Rhames?
I wonder if maybe scheduling issues and maybe. Like, oh, we'll just have you do a cameo. Who knows? But I mean, him and Tom Cruise are the biggest two. They're in every one. So, yeah.
What else is Ving Rhames doing other than...
I know. That's what I was thinking. Yeah, you never know. He's doing the Arby's commercials, which he does a great job of, by the way. Uh-huh. Arby's, we have the meats.
Is that him?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
I love those commercials. And he does a great job on those. Anyway, I don't know what he's doing, but maybe...
Brian Cox doing McDonald's commercials.
Why did they get Brian Cox? I don't get that.
Why do you have to have, I just, as a low level actor and as a commercial actor, it actually drives me nuts when big brands have these have these huge, really successful actors doing things that I'm like, does that really help? Are people like, oh, Brian Cox is selling Big Macs. I guess, you know what? I guess I'll go get a Big Mac then. It's like, it also I hope they never figure this out. I'm glad that they don't, because I want the jobs. I need the money for when I can get them. But it's like, there are some brands that I'm like, you you don't need to make McDonald's commercials anymore. We know that McDonald's exists. Like, yeah, you don't like, yeah. like there are no In-N-Out ads, and people know the In-N-Out burger exists. Like, we know what the Golden Arch is. You could go 20 years without making another McDonald's commercial, and I don't think you would see a dip in sales.
Probably not. Yeah.
I think that people know what it is. There's not Starbucks commercials. Like, the, you know? Like,
no. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm off track.
Yeah, we both got off track on that one. But
we are... Funnily enough, we're both in our parents' houses.
yes, we are.
As two near 40 men. Yes. So this is really cool, talking about movies in our parents' houses.
Yeah, and you're in Utah and I'm in California, so we switch places.
We switch places.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, this is a franchise that I think mostly goes down really well. This is my personal favorite film in the franchise.
Oh, okay. Nice.
I'm glad we chose to do this one. I think this is like the most, well, I'd say two is the most unique, but this is the most unique that works to me. This one is the one that feels like it's the biggest departure from the formula, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It really, really is, especially the beginning. Well, yeah. after the intro. Yeah, he's in a completely different place.
Right.
They took a big swing with that. But yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, we can get into our little plot breakdown now. I think obviously if you haven't seen Mission Impossible 3, you know,
spoilers.
It's a 20-year-old movie. This is a 30-year-old franchise at this point. That's crazy. But spoilers,
like 20 years. Oh my gosh. Yeah,
20 years ago. I remember seeing this in the theater and thinking, "Boy, Tom Cruise probably can't do this for much longer."
Right? And he does it 20 more years.
I thought that 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I was wrong. And I'll probably be thinking the same thing in 10 years, you know?
Yeah, probably. But did we see this together? I can't remember. We talked about it all the time. Like, we were, when it came out, it was, I remember not expecting much and being very blown away by how much I loved this movie. And I still kind of feel that same way.
So I will say, when I first saw this in the theater, I do like the way that they've decided to edit this opening scene to take something from the end of the film as like a teaser for what's coming later. And we don't really have context to know exactly what we're looking at.
Yeah.
But the scene still, we feel through the performances, the stakes and the weight of the scene.
Yes.
I will say on rewatches, I'm kind of like, I get why they did this. It's a great hook, but I kind of wish, it's such a good scene. I kind of wish that we could enjoy the scene in its entirety with all 10 counts.
Right.
When it actually takes place chronologically in the story later on.
Right.
Because I think that some of the emotional weight of the scene is lost on us, especially if you're a viewer of the film for the first time, seeing it with it. Obviously, again, it's a great way to grab the audience's attention. Like, we're like, oh, okay, Ethan's in trouble. Something really intense is happening. Philip Seymour Hoffman's in this movie. He's scary. But if that, I think that scene would actually hit harder if we didn't see it at the beginning. You know?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And I have wondered that as well, because I feel like this entire movie, this is J.J. Abrams' first feature film that he directed. And it's an interesting story how he got the job. They had like David Fincher, according to Wikipedia, David Fincher was working on this movie for a long time. And then they got Carnahan. What's it? Joe Carnahan, I think, to work on that for a long time. And then I guess they had creative differences. So then Tom Cruise just like binged Alias and was like, hey, let's get J.J. Abrams to do it. So he was like, I'd love to do it. Right. Who wouldn't? But this was his first time directing a feature film. And I feel he even says it, like, I've listened to some commentaries of him and read some stuff about him, and like, you can tell that he's pretty new. I mean, he does an amazing job. Like, this is not taking away from the movie, but there's definitely some things that I'm like, okay, this feels kind of like more like a TV show thing than like a movie thing. And I can forgive it because it's not the worst thing. It's more like, it's a little weird that that's in there, but you can kind of see that he's a little inexperienced, but that's like such a nitpick. I don't want that to be like a negative. It's like, you know, even when he says like, oh, I didn't really know what I was really finding myself as a director here, which he found it really quick because he is an amazing director.
Well, here's what I would say about J.J. Abrams as a director in general. Yeah. What I observe a lot in his films is there's this layer of insecurity and self-consciousness.
Yes.
And that's what I feel like is this choice is like, oh, they're not going to, if we just start with Ethan at a party and he's like engaged and it takes us a while to, and it takes us like 5 to 10 minutes to get into the first action sequence, they're not going to forgive us. And it's like, sure we will. We've already, you know, we've already bought the ticket. Trust the movie. Trust that Tom Cruise is a big enough movie star that we know it's okay.
And they get, we get into after the first opening scene, we get into the action pretty quick after that.
Oh yeah.
So I think it could have been fine. It would be interesting to see, but I'm sure I totally agree. It does kind of come off as like he's not confident in himself. His insecurities kind of.
And who knows if it was a J.J. Abrams as a young director having final cut decision, or if it was the studio coming in and going, is there anything we can start with to really give us a punch at the, you know, who knows if it was a studio note, but because these movies, again, like I talk about the formula of these films, they are very formulaic as a franchise in general, and there's kind of a structure to them. And typically they start with some kind of attention grabbing action sequence. Yes. This movie doesn't necessarily start with an action sequence, but it starts high intensity.
Yes.
It starts in the middle of a, you know, it's sort of a disorienting thing, and it's a structural thing that can work. My problem with it is it's such a good scene.
Yeah.
And it's such a good moment for these two actors that I'm like, boy, if they had saved that for because then when we come back to it and we actually do the thing where we sort of edit away from it and we kind of cut out the middle, I'm like, now you used the scene in the wrong spot.
Yeah. I totally agree. Especially Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
Just like the way to start this off, which he's not in the movie much comparatively, which I actually like because you always want people wanting more. Right. And I always want more of Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is a great thing.
Every time I see this movie, I'm convinced that he's in more of it than he is. And and then I'm like, boy, he's in like four scenes.
Yeah.
And like three of them where he like actually talks and has, but he's so compelling. He's just so interesting. Yes. And
the best thing you can do in an action movie, the best thing you can do for your protagonist is to have a good antagonist. It will make everything better. Like when you have a great antagonist, it just makes everything work so much smoother. The best action movies have the best antagonists usually, right? So, and this one, he is amazing. I love 5 and 6with Lane, Solomon Lane. He is amazing. Lane. That's 7 and 8. We'll get into this more when we review
one of the eight. One of the big problems with 7 and 8 is there's not a strong enough fill in. It's the problem with 4 too. With 4, I'm just like, I don't really care about this guy.
Exactly. Like, exactly. It's like, really, who is this guy? He's like, he's not going to stand up to Tom Cruise. Like this old guy. Like what is.
And it's maybe one of the best things about 2 is that like, is he's fun.
Almost Wolverine.
Almost Wolverine.
Doug Ray Scott.
Doug Ray Scott is a lot of fun in 2.
He is. Well, and
1 has a great villain. I really like John Voight.
And it's a good twist, right? Uh-huh. It's a great twist. So it's a great one. Yep. But yeah, Doug Ray Scott, the funny thing about him too is that the great thing that they did for him is that him and Ethan are like the same person. You know, they play off each other all the time, even in the movie. Like, oh, you've worn a mask as him before, you know, like, oh, so it's kind of that like mirror image type thing, but it is a good villain, even though the movie overall isn't great, but Philip Seymour Hoffman is him and Solomon Lane are probably the two villains in this franchise that just totally stand out as the ones that every time they're on screen, I want to watch what they're doing. And I love that they're they're not taking huge swings, but they are really like villainous in the perfect way. And Philip Seymour Hoffman is so good in this.
Philip Seymour Hoffman as an actor is the antithesis of self-consciousness and insecurity. He is he is somehow, I watched a video essay about him recently on YouTube about how like it's crazy the career that he had, because it's truly odds defying in Hollywood. It's so hard for a person who looks like Philip Seymour Hoffman to have a career as a serious, like, leading man actor, you know, number one, like a big heavy hitter movie star. Right. And he started out kind of as like a character actor who would show up, you know, like we talked about, like Twister, and he would play these kind of funny side characters. But once people got a glimpse of what he was capable of doing, and people like Paul Thomas Anderson started giving him bigger opportunities to show off, and Hollywood started letting him play bigger parts, and people really got to see like what he was bringing to the table. Every time he was given an opportunity to shine, he would step up to the plate with like such confidence for a guy who's like, doesn't look like a traditional movie star, and does, you know, and this movie, it's like, he's not even trying. Yeah. It's like, it's, you know, that's what's amazing is that, that it's like he's, you know, it's like he's lifting 500 pounds with one finger, and he's like not doing anything. He's just like, it's so simple, and the simplicity of it makes him, because the character feels so untouchable. Owen Davian just feels like, dude, you don't know who I am. You don't know.
He's
like, you know?
So confident, not even to the point of cocky, just which I love, because it's just like, no, you don't even know what you're into. Like, you're not even worth my time, basically.
Yeah,
like, I love how he plays this character. And then he just immediately, like, this opening scene is such a great show off for his character, because he just starts and he's like, where's the rabbit foot? Where's the rabbit's foot, Ethan? Right. And he's like, that's what I gave you, you know, and he's just like, he's totally fine. And then it escalates. And when he escalates, when he shoots her in the leg, and like he just starts yelling, it's like, oh, my, like he came to play. Like this guy is, this scene is, as you say, so great. It's so well done. But I agree. I think it's in the wrong spot. They probably should have just kept it at the end.
Yeah, unfortunately. But yeah, so we start out with this sort of attention grabbing scene, and then we do our big intro with the Fuse and Mission Impossible 3. By the way, this is the last one in the franchise that doesn't have a subtitle. It's Mission Impossible, MI2, and then MI3, no subtitle, just Mission Impossible 3, and then from here on out, they all have subtitles. This is, then we go to, this is what I like about this movie. We go to an engagement party for Ethan Hunt, and it's not like a cover story or like something that he's not like on a job and he's pretending to be engaged to this woman and they're trying to get close to somebody. Like, it is what I like about this movie is it's the one time I feel like in this entire franchise where we see Ethan Hunt attempting to be a normal guy.
Yes.
And just attempting to have a normal life. And it's such a fascinating thing to be like, what would James Bond do if he was just like trying his hardest to truly be a civilian? And I, you know, they talk about it in the movie. His team talks about how like people like us can't do that. We can't. And in a way, I think this movie, you know, the kind of Mission Impossible that J.J. Abrams wanted to talk about is the mission of like, can Tom Cruise be a normal person? Can he have a normal life? Yeah. And it's like, oh, the real impossible mission is marriage.
You can't be married in this profession. Well, Jonathan Rhys Meyers loves it.
Right.
Loves having no attachments. But yeah.
But hey, I love that. But you see, I love that.
That theme actually runs throughout the rest of the series.
Right.
Because I mean, for the reason he had to get away, this was the first time, 3 and 4 are the first time that movies are literally connected, because in the end of 4, he got out to save her so that she could have a normal life. Right. So, and then it keeps playing out in the rest of it. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. They all talk about you can't have a normal relationship, right? And that's kind of the most impossible mission, as you said. So.
Which, you know, which it's kind of sad to me, because this movie does seem to end with him accomplishing the mission. Like, it seems like the reason why this is my favorite movie in the franchise is because it seems like Ethan's only mission the entire time is to get out and to have a normal life. And by the end of the movie, he seemingly accomplishes it. He does it. And what I like about the movie is that what Owen Davian, who Owen Davian is, what he's doing, what the rabbit's foot is, what the IMF mission is, kind of doesn't really matter to Ethan. Ethan's, yeah. It matters because his friend died and he cares about, you know, avenging the death of his student, Carrie Russell.
Right, right.
But he doesn't really care about like making sure IMF successfully completes another mission. Yeah. His mission is to just successfully get out and be like, I need to sort this situation out and then I'm going to go get married and be done. Yeah. And so it is a little bit sad that the rest of the franchise kind of undercuts the end of this film, that it's like, actually, no.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It undercuts it.
Yeah.
At least it does it. I feel like it does it in a respectful way. As far as the real reason is like, hey, these are making money. We got to make more. Right. And Tom Cruise is like, hey, I love making these movies, so let's keep making them, which I am very happy that they did. And they did it respectfully in the sense that like, he tried, he failed because people came after him. So it was like, okay. And then Jules keeps coming up, right? She keeps coming up and showing up in, you know, she shows up in 4 and she shows up in 6 and her story's kind of ended. But yes, it does definitely undercut, like, he got out, but then he didn't.
There's one last thing I want to mention before we keep moving through the plot of this film. And that's that I always wear like a hat or something about the film that we're watching.
Yeah.
And today I just did my hair, because a big thing in this franchise is the trade-off of when Tom Cruise has short hair versus when he has long hair. Yeah. And I was literally like going through it. And I was like, okay, so 1, short hair, 2, long hair, 3, short hair. 4, long hair. We're back. We split. We boom, 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 boom.
Yep.
And then I'm pretty sure we go 4, 5, long hair.
Yeah.
6, 7, short hair.
Yes.
8, we're back.
Long hair. Yep.
8, we're long so hair. Now we got 4 and 4. So they literally went half and half. And I was like, that is so funny that I can definitely see Tom Cruise and like his stylist being like, it's got to be even.
Well, what do you prefer? Do you like the short hair or do you like the long hair?
I like short hair Cruise.
I like short hair Cruise too. I'm a short hair Cruise guy. Yeah. Like, yes, stick with the short, but it's all good.
The long hair Cruise always seems a little corny to me. It always seems a little bit like he's trying to be like Keith Urban or like, you know, like the singer of a band or something. And I'm like, no, dude, the short hair seems more tactical.
It seems
more like the haircut that a field agent would have.
He kind of blends in a little bit more.
Yeah, the long hair always looks like he's trying to be like a pretty boy. And it's like, no, I don't like that.
I agree. You know? I agree.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Anyway, so he's at his engagement party. He gets a call on the phone that is all in code, as they normally do. He goes down to 7-Eleven and meets up with Billy Crudup. And Billy Crudup gives him a disposable camera. Billy Crudup's always fun.
Yeah. And he's a kind of a chameleon actor. I mean, not in the set. He usually plays about the same part, but.
Sure.
It's like, oh yeah, that guy, like, he's actually a good actor. I liked him in this one.
I actually really like the way that Abrams and Crudup handle the misdirect with this character.
Yes.
There's a lot of scenes where it seems like Billy Crudup's kind of like getting one over on the boss, Lawrence Fishburne, who's the actual bad guy, and that Billy Crudup and Ethan Hunt are working together to be like, this guy, this guy's crooked. But when you watch it knowing what you know, you're actually like, oh, Billy Crudup the whole time is just scheming. And,
and
none of his stuff that seems like he's being bros with Ethan is actually genuine.
Yes.
And that it plays too. You can see it in the performance. And it's a clever little, they hide it well. But anyway, he gives him a disposable camera. Ethan goes back to his garage. I like that. You know, I always like the different ways that
they get it. It's in glasses. It's in a thing. It's on a, recording. And they all self-destruct. That's all pretty good.
Yep. And he finds out that his student Carrie Russell was kidnapped in the field. Normally their sort of standard line of what they say with every mission is, if you're kidnapped or detained in the field, we will disavow any knowledge of you as an agent. That's just protocol. Yep. They say we would normally disavow, however, she's got intel on Owen Davian that we need or something.
I can't remember exactly. They make it clear like, oh, he hasn't killed her and we're wondering why or something. It's
yeah. Yeah. So they are sent in on an extraction to get her out. Ethan, you know, kind of pulled in for one last mission kind of thing, to get his student out. We have a nice action sequence here.
Yes. I like it.
Nicely staged. And I kind of like this whole thing of like shoving the adrenaline into Carrie Russell.
Yeah.
And I like the magnetic bombs and
yeah. I got to ask you.
Yeah.
What do you think of Carrie Russell?
I think Carrie Russell
in this movie.
Oh, I don't, I mean, I don't know that she has enough time to really shine. Like, yeah. I know that she can, but I also think that like, she's here because of JJ Abrams. Like she's
that's,
here.
Yeah. That's what I thought too. Like, yeah. I really like Carrie Russell as an actress, mm-hmm. as an actor. And, but in this one, it just, I don't know. It's, I think you're right. I think it's the time. Like she's in it so little that I don't feel like I get enough sense of who she is. And it's hard for me to buy her character in this movie, but I think it is because it's so quick.
That being said, Philip Seymour Hoffman also has very little screen time and
very true. Very true.
We have no problem buying his, you know, so who knows?
This is the other thing that I kind of noticed about this movie. This is a small nitpick. They kind of like Tom Cruise in this movie repeats himself so much. Like, hey Tom, there's M18 in the truck. He's like, I know. He's like, get down. Come on.
Oh, yeah. You know what? The 2000s were the era of that.
Yeah.
The 2000s action movies, like that was Shia LaBeouf in like Transformers. Yeah. No. Like that was the thing. The action movies in the 2000s was the repeat.
It was weird. Yeah. And this is really bad. And she kind of does it too. And mm-hmm. I think it just, anyway, but. She is on the verge of death. Sorry, did you have something to say?
Oh, I was just going to say what's really interesting about this movie too, speaking of the 2000s, is how we are just on the cusp of all tech changing massively when this movie was made. Like we're still doing flip phones and we're still like, there's a lot of tech in this movie where like, we were like a couple years away from when all the tech changed, when iPhones changed everything and tablets. And so like everything's everything. It's weird watching it because it feels like a very modern movie, but it's like the very last era of a lot of the tech that they're using.
Well, it came out in 2006.
Yeah.
The iPhone came out in 2007, right? I'm pretty sure it was 2007. So it was, and it is kind of funny. They're big, like flip phones and they look real, but immediately they were dated. Like a year later. But
anyway, so they I always liked this this shot where he throws the gun to Carrie Russell and the camera tracks the gun into her hand,
catches it.
I always thought that was cool. And then I've always, you know, I liked the little like, how many rounds do you have left? Enough. And he runs out and takes the one shot and blows the guy through the window.
Now I'm out. I do love Tom Cruise's little tactical moves, right, with his gun. I imagine he does it very authentically.
Accurately.
It looks pretty good.
Yeah, it's an action star.
Oh, yeah. It's a fun, and this is, like you said, this is a fun sequence. They have a great, in the warehouse or wherever they are, and then they go out and they go in and have a cool helicopter chase.
Yeah, and Carrie Russell's got the chip in her head.
Yeah. This is okay. This is the weird thing about this too. And this maybe goes, I don't know if this is as much a performance issue as I was wondering. So she's just like, oh, can you not hear that? Like, oh, what is that sound? And it, you know, it's like, that's kind of weird. Why didn't they have like a ringing, like switch to her perspective and have a ringing going on? Right. She's like, oh, what, you know? So then we're like experiencing it with her. And then you switch to Tom's perspective and he can't hear anything. But like giving us that, like right now, it's just kind of, she has to act like there's something going on and we have no idea what she's hearing. And they do it later on with Tom Cruise as well.
Right.
And I'm also like, why can't, like, then the same, like, why didn't you do an audio cue of like a ringing that would cue us into like, oh crap. Because when Tom has it, he kind of does the same thing acting wise, but I feel like an audio cue would have been a little bit better.
I can see that, but I also kind of like that it's all just performance. Okay. I kind of like that we're experiencing the mystery of it.
Right.
It's like, oh, wait, what's going on? What's something bad is happening, that it could be like a bug that's inside of her, you know,
right.
I kind of like that it, we experience it through the eyes of everyone else, that everyone else is like, what's happening? What, you know, what's going on? I do like that they establish the defibrillator here, that it's like, we can, there's a way to disarm this explosive charge in her head. If we zap her, but they don't get there in time. And I like this effect of when this thing goes off in her brain and it turns her eyeballs into soup, and it is
all over the place. It is so creepy. It looks so bad.
It's effective.
It is effective. Yeah. It looks
the
bad.
The way that her face like snaps. And
yeah. She's like,
yep. And it literally looks like a little explosion went off in her brain. It's like, Yeah.
And her eyes are looking in two different spots, and it's,
it's really gross. They're like,
it is jelly, effective. Yeah. Yeah.
Jelly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's gross, but I mean, it is pretty sad. And you know, this is kind of a good thing. This is a good way to establish stakes in a movie, right? When you kill a character, you kill a character like this, it's like, man, there's real danger. You know, like that's, they don't save her. They really get her. So it really ups the stakes pretty quickly, which I think is an effective use of that.
Also, the way that the scene is built, it feels like they're going to. It's like there's a solution. It's like, I know, we have the defibrillator. Yeah. Here we go. If we shock her, we can, you know, you're like, they're going to come up with a solution here. And then when it doesn't work, you're like, And it's also a very good motivation to get Ethan back in the field to say, okay, so Ethan, obviously his mission for this movie is I got to get out. I'm just trying to get married to this woman that I met. But somebody kills his student and he finds out he's got a chance to, they have some intel on where Owen Davian is. He's going to be at the Vatican, and Ethan goes, all right, let's go get him.
Which is the first scene with Benji Dunn.
Right.
This is the thing. We see Benji and he's like, oh, you know, like I'm going to get a promotion for this. Right. And I don't know why he stands out so much. I think it's just how great Simon Pegg is, because I love Simon Pegg, and he doesn't do anything as far as like, he does nothing, but he stands out so much that his character is so endearing.
It's really not easy to be in a movie that takes itself like pretty seriously and be the comic relief and do it without feeling forced or hokey. Simon makes Benji feel like a real character in this world.
Yes.
And every time he kind of ad libs or does little asides, they feel natural. And there's a good dynamic between him and Ethan too.
Oh yeah. And it's crazy how he does that through the entire rest of the series. Mm-hmm. Like, he is the comic relief, but he works so well off of Tom Cruise, and like every movie after this. And then he has moments where he genuinely has to act, like in Five, he has to pretend that he hates Ethan, right? And like, he has that interview and he really has to give like an emotional performance, not like huge emotional, but like he has emotional moments, and I buy them. So I buy him as the serious actor when he needs to be, but I also buy him as the comic relief. It's pretty amazing that out of two scenes, he was able to create this amazing character that we all love. And I mean, and it's, I think the biggest reason is because he's like, okay, he talks about the anti-god, right? He says, it's talking about something about the rabbit's foot. And he's like, well, what's rabbit's foot? He's like, well, we have this, you know, we had this professor, and you know, he's a really fat guy, and it's really funny. And then he's like, he would scare everybody and say that technology is what will eviscerate everything as we know it. And he's like, whenever I hear people talking about spending this much money on something like this, I think of the anti-god, which is what the professor was talking about, which is basically the end of the world stuff. And this is a very much a J.J. Abrams,
mystery box trope.
He loves to put things out there that don't have answers so that people can fill in the blanks themselves. Now, I think this works extremely effectively in this movie. I don't think it always works with what he does.
So this is what I'm talking about with J.J. Abrams as kind of like an insecure or self-conscious storyteller, is this mystery box trope. It's not that, because it is effective in this movie and it's thematically right for this film.
Yes.
It's actually right that it doesn't matter what the rabbit's foot is. It's just another MacGuffin. Ethan's had to go and get every different kind of, this kill switch is going to trigger the end of, he's had to do this a million times in his career and he doesn't care what it is. His mission is not the rabbit's foot. His mission is just, I got to stop Owen Davian so I can get back to my wife. That's Ethan's whole thing. and it's right for the movie, but J.J. Abrams puts it into everything and it kind of becomes an excuse for writing. It does. Just sort of like, well, if I can just sort of have the audience write it in their head for me, I don't need to write it. And it works well in this movie, though.
Yes, it does. Yeah. So this is great. And then they know, okay, we got to go to the Vatican.
Right.
And they all go to the Vatican. And,
great action sequence, or great little like Mission Impossible sequence. Lots of
I do love this. And it's really well constructed.
Mm-hmm.
And this also, this movie was written by Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orci and J.J. Abrams. And Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orci have written some great stuff. They've also written some really bad stuff. But this whole sequence is so well set up. I mean, it's a long sequence. They have to get into the Vatican. And then when they get there, they have to run back and forth. And I like how you're seeing how they have to set up every little piece to make the next piece work. Right. And so you see the sequence of events that have to play all like dominoes in a row.
And when we talk about when we talk about stuff for the rest of the franchise, kind of following the blueprint of this film, this is one of those things. Is this doesn't really exist to this degree in 1 and 2, where we see every step, where they show us like in 1 and 2 have masks, but we don't ever get to see like how are the masks made? What's the tech behind the masks? This I love. For the first time in 3, we get to see like that they have to take this 3D scan of Owen Davian's face, and then they've got to 3D print the mask right there on site. Then they've got to, you know, get him to read this thing so they can do the voice cloning. And like, I love that there's like, and this has become now a staple of the franchise going forward, that in the middle of every single movie, there's some prolonged sequence like this where the team has to get into somewhere like the Kremlin or something that's really hard to get into. And we get to see lots of little intricate pieces of how they're going to do that.
Yeah.
And how they're going to accomplish these seemingly impossible things. And this one was like the first time that I was like, oh, they're really like letting us in on the nitty gritty of like every little.
Yeah.
And it's really fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And they play with this in movies after this, right? They're trying to make one, but it breaks, and they're trying to make a mask and it breaks. Anyway, this is fun. It was really fun to see like, oh, they're making the mask and like, they got to get it on and he's got to do all this stuff. And I liked that this became kind of a staple because it really is a fun sequence to see all of it unfold. And I mean, they have to get, you know, and I like how he's the voice imprint hasn't uploaded yet, which is also really funny because like AI does this now and it does it really quick. Like we use it at my job and it is kind of funny. Anyway, just a little funny thing that they predicted, but the voice hasn't uploaded yet to his little voice box thing or whatever. And so he's got a stall, you know, and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is sitting behind the door with Philip Seymour Hoffman and the bodyguards like right there. And he's just like trying to stall him and he's telling him to wait. He's like,
but also this scene too, like, it's like the bodyguard is saying, is everything all right, sir? Just look at him and go.
Yeah,
just nod. Just look at him and nod.
Oh wait, yeah, shoo him away.
But he just like looks at him and doesn't say anything. And I'm like, could you be more suspicious? Could you? So you know, true. Come on. But but it's fun. But this is also we have to remember Philip Seymour Hoffman. Like I love the performance that Phil Hoffman does as Ethan Hunt in the. Owen Davian mask. And that's also a fun part of his performance is like, you get to see that layer to it.
Yeah. And like he goes out and they open the, you know, the Lamborghini thing and Ving Rhames like, what's up? Or he's like,
what's up?
Philip Seymour's like, what's up? Nothing. He's like, nothing. What's up with you? Nothing. It's like, I do love that performance of him playing Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
Playing him. So
I also like in this sequence when Ving Rhames is trying to talk Tom Cruise out of getting married and saying like, hey, this just isn't for us. And I like this little effect of him putting on the silicone mask and then Ving Rhames is touching him with his thumbs and they sort of do this digital effect where it just seamlessly turns into Philip Seymour Hoffman as he's pressing the mask in. But then he stops him and goes, Luther, Jules and I got married 2 days ago. You know, and it's like, oh, well, congratulations. Man.
Yeah. No, I thought that was funny too. I do have to ask though, we actually skipped over this part because Jules is getting suspicious.
Yeah.
You know, Tom Cruise is like, oh, I work for the DOT or whatever, which I'm like,
yeah.
Why did you choose that cover? Like, what, right. Why would you? Anyway, but the, you know, he's telling her, I felt like between him and Jules, like their scenes, I felt like it was a little forced. And like, it was a little like, I'm not really like buying this. Like, why is she so suspicious? They made it a little bit like way, like more dramatic than I felt like it needed to be.
Sure. Yeah. Like, it's literally just her husband being like, I have to go away on business. And she's like, Ethan, what's going on?
Yeah.
Why do you always have to go away for business? And it's like, cause I have a job that sometimes I have to be out of town for, but it's like, and also like, apparently for most of their relationship, he's not been a field agent.
Yeah.
So he's his job is just at, so when he goes off to like work, he's just going down the road. Yeah, he's not like leaving. Yeah. He's not like going out into the field and doing missions. And so it's really only like in the last week that he's left town twice. He's just like, sorry, I got to go back out on the road. And she's like, what's happening, Ethan? She's like, what?
Just
like,
tell us we're okay. Tell me just, we're okay.
Ethan, like, what's going on? Like, you know, but I do think, yeah, this film has some heavy lifting to do to be like, we've got to sell this. We got to sell that between movie 2 and movie 3, Ethan Hunt got in such a serious relationship that he's willing to change his entire life for it, and that nothing matters to him. And you know what makes this relationship work is Tom Cruise's performance.
And
it's not even in the scenes between the two of them. It's like when Jules is not in the movie and Tom Cruise is talking about her, we see through him
what
she means to him, you know? But yeah, their scenes are a little bit like, let's get through. You know,
but I do like Michelle Monaghan. Like she does well for what she has to do.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
And later on in the series, like I love when she came back in 6 and what she does in 6, but yeah, they make it work. They make it work.
For sure. So they get Owen Davian out of there. They fake his death. And we just have an excellent scene on an airplane. And this is really, I mean, again, you know, the movie, that opening scene is great. But if this was our first scene getting to really know Owen Davian, I think that even, and it kind of is. In some ways, it's like, okay, at this point in the movie, this is our first time really getting to like see the deal with Owen Davian. And what's so cool about the construction of this scene is the guy is zip tied to a bench and surrounded by spies who have just pulled off a heist in the Vatican to kidnap him. He should be at this point. He should, and they've told him, we just faked your death. There are witnesses. You're dead. We're taking you in.
Yeah.
He should be concerned. And he's just like, he just doesn't even care. Yeah. He's just cool as a cucumber.
Yep. And he doesn't even like, Tom Cruise starts talking to him and he doesn't even listen to his questions.
Yeah.
He's like, what's your name? You know, like who are you?
You have a girlfriend? You have like a wife or something? You know?
Yeah. It's amazing how quickly they get into this scene. And again, Tom Cruise does a great job. They both do a great job playing off of each other because you can just see how pissed Tom Cruise is. Mm-hmm. And you can see that Philip Seymour Hoffman is not really enjoying it, but knowing that he's getting to him, you know? And it's like such a great scene because he throws him over the, whatever the latch is. I don't know. You open the cargo hold.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah,
he starts cutting the zip ties and Philip Seymour Hoffman keeps falling further and further. And he's just fine. Like you can see that he's like,
doesn't care.
Yeah. But he's like, all right, just go for it. Like, I'm not going to do anything. So
yeah,
it's crazy.
But that's the choice that he makes for this character, that this guy just does not blink, that this guy just like he has just a poker face of steel, that it's like, cool, cut me out of the bench and kill me. But he's but also in his brain, like, he's smart enough to know like, you're never going to do that.
Yeah.
Like the whole point of bringing me in is to try to get intel from me. Right. So I'm useless to you if you drop me out of this plane. But I also love that since he knows that, like, I love like that, you know, like, I'm a finder and a herder, you know, but it's so simple. And then when he talks about Kerry Russell and he's like, oh, your friend. He's like, yeah. Oh, you know, that what I did to her, that was just fun. That was fun.
Yeah.
The way that
he
says that is so, it's so ice cold.
Oh,
it's so like just,
yeah,
it was fun.
Yeah, you know? Just like, yeah. Oh, he doesn't even care about her.
Yeah.
And your little blonde friend, right? Like demeaning yep. her. Like mm-hmm. it's played so well. And then Ving Rhames comes over and takes him off. He's like, Ethan, this is not us, you know? And then he throws him back. And then I love the line that Philip Seymour Hoffman gives to him. He's like, what does he say? You could probably do it better. But basically he says,
what I'm selling and who I'm selling to is the last thing you should be worried about.
Ethan. Yeah, I love he says his name. Yeah. And he's like, well, I know your name. So it's basically, I mean, because in this scene, he won.
Uh-huh.
He won. He's in handcuffs. He's zip tied, whatever. He won. He found out his name. He knows who he is. Like, that's it. That's all he needs.
He knows that he has a tracker on his body that his team is tracking. He knows that they know exactly where he is. And he knows that he is not going to be in custody for longer than 24 hours. Yeah. And so he's just like, if I find out your name, it's game over, man. Like, you know, and so, and it's so weird to have a villain like that who's beaten and who's just like, oh no, I'm not beaten. Like, you know,
you haven't won.
I'm annoyed. I'm really frustrated that you like ruined my deal back there and that you spilled wine on my custom shirt and then you hung me out of an airplane. I'm annoyed, but I'm not scared. I'm not, you know, and I'm definitely not like bothered anyway. So they bring him in. And Lawrence Fishburne is waiting for them when they get there, you know. That's later.
No. They get to the air, you know, they get on the airship or whatever. And then this is where we have the bridge scene, mm-hmm. which I think this scene is one of the funnest scenes in all of the franchise. Oh,
it's great.
So
it's fantastic.
Cool.
And I love the stunts and I love, I will say, I want to talk about Billy Crudup again, like the way that they mask his arc. There's a scene when they've just gotten Owen Davey in. Billy Crudup goes into Lawrence Fishburne's office and he goes, Ethan Hunt and his team just detained.
Yeah.
Yeah. They just grabbed Owen Davey in at, you know, in Italy and they're bringing him in. And Lawrence Fishburne goes, and were you aware of this operation? And he thinks for a second, goes, yes, I was. Then he goes, good work. And what we think the first time we're watching it is that he's like, yeah, I was. So, you know, and he's kind of sticking it to the boss. But actually on rewatch, it's like, no, he wasn't involved with the mission. And he's just taking credit for something that he had nothing to do with because he's just kind of like a bad person.
You know? He's trying to save his own butt. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that is a great scene. Yeah. Then they're on the bridge. And they're going, everything is.
Do you know about this bridge, by the way, in real life? Do you know about this?
Is this the Chesapeake Bay Bridge? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just know that that's it.
The people who live there in real life, people have they call it like panic attack bridge because people who drive on it have panic attacks while they're driving on it because it's such a long stretch of road to be over water. It's just a very, very, very long bridge. And there are people who live in that area who will drive your car for you across the bridge. You can pay them and that's what they do for work is they drive. So you'll get in the passenger seat and they will drive you across the bridge because it's so nerve wracking for people. So that's just a fun little bit of crazy. Like trivia about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The bridge. Yeah, but they're going along, and then all of a sudden, a car behind them just blows up, right? And it flips over, and then they've got this drone that's kind of coming back and forth.
He gets the micro dot from Carrie Russell's character, finally. But they weren't able to translate the data from it until this moment.
That's right.
In the car. Yeah, they're in the car behind Owen Davey and then he's like, hey, the message from so-and-so just came through, and he sees it, and she's like, it's Lawrence Fishburne. He set me up. Like, I think that he's working with Owen Davey. And as he's looking at that message, the car behind him blows up.
Yes. And it's a great information point, you know, it blows up and then everything kind of everything hits the fan and cars are blowing up, and then they get these helicopters. These helicopters come up, right? Well, Ethan's car rolls over, and he's like disoriented. Him and Ving Rhames are like disoriented, so they're trying to help everybody. But then these helicopters come up, and they like get out and they spray this like orange goo on the side of the van that's holding Owen Davian, which I love this look. I don't even know what this is, but I love the look of it, right? They're spraying it.
You know what I like about this is that even in 2006, when I saw this in the theaters, I got what it was without knowing. I like that I don't even know what this tech is. And I'm like, I get what that is. It's something that makes the metal able to be broken.
Well, and you can hear it like they've got, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they make it sound like ice. It starts going white, you know, and it's like you hear the metal, like, you know, compacting or whatever it is. And then it just like they smack it and it shatters.
Yeah.
So it freezes it, I guess, and then makes it brittle. I don't know. But it is great. I got that as well. And
yeah, Cruz has two great stunts in this sequence. He has one where he jumps a big giant gap, and that's really fun. But my favorite is, and it's one of my favorites in the whole franchise.
Oh, me too. Yeah. I love it. He's running away. He sees that the drone has shot a missile. He's trying to get the gun out. He gets the gun out of the car. He throws it and he's running from the explosion, right? This is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then the car blows up and he smacks up against the wall, the side of another car and all the windows blow out. Why is that scene so cool?
It's just so cool. It's just such a cool. And I also remember just watching the special features as a kid on the DVD. And I loved that, like, in order to do the stunt right. What's cool about it is, like, Tom Cruise is running full speed. Of course he is. He runs full speed in every movie he's ever in. But he's running full speed, and he's on a full body harness that they're yanking him into that car on. And he told them, you can't tell me when you're doing it. Don't say 3, 2, 1, none of that. I'm just going to run, and you just pull me. And so, so it's just a thing that he was just willing to, like, fully throw his body into. And he's running full speed, and they just yank him into this car as hard as they can, and he, like, his whole body, like, folds up against this car, and it just looks awesome.
It does.
It's just a really cool
great stunt that he gives his all for. He gives his all for all of these stunts.
Yeah, right?
Like, everything. That's what makes these movies. One of the things that makes these movies so exciting is just the effort that he himself puts into it with his body and everything. Mm-hmm. And this one is great. He gets thrown up against the car. And then he does put the gun together and he takes out the drone, but they get Owen Davian and they take him away. And then
I love how quickly things progress from this point, that it's just like that he knows immediately. Oh no. This, like, I love the fear from Ethan Hunt of, like, I just witnessed that guy for the last, whatever it is, 12 hours or so, not flinch when I faked his death. Had him detained on a plane. He didn't flinch, but he told me he was going to hurt my wife if I have a wife. So he calls his house, and immediately, immediately Owen Davian has gone to work on Ethan Hunt. Been like, I told you, man. Like, the first thing I'm doing is I'm going and getting your wife and not wasting any time. And I love that, you know, a fun little role for Aaron Paul before he was Aaron.
In
this movie
plays another druggie. So he was typecast, I guess.
This was probably like 1 or 2 years before Breaking Bad debuted on AMC. But he runs to the hospital where Jules works. We see that Jules is kidnapped by one of Davian's guys. I always kind of like this little, like, the evil creepiness of the scene. Yeah. And I also like the staging of this scene, how he runs into her on the stretcher.
I like that too. Yeah.
It's great. Great staging.
Like, oh, you're so close. So close.
Yeah. And it's it's just like, oh no.
Yeah.
And then he comes out to the parking lot. I love this phone call too. This is like another, like Philip Seymour Hoffman's just so cold on this call.
Yeah.
Just calls him on the phone. He's like, hey, you hung me outside of an airplane. So, and when he starts yelling at him, and he's like, don't threaten me. Okay. Yeah. He's like, look, what are you doing? Like, you know, like, I have your wife. Don't threaten me. What are you doing?
Exactly. Like, And then Lawrence Fishburne takes Ethan in. He gets him, he detains him, which I always thought this scene was kind of funny.
Yeah.
They've got him in like Hannibal Lecter. Like,
I know. I'm like, why does he need to be in a muzzle? I don't know why.
I don't get that. And they have him completely tied down on a stretcher. Like,
it seems extreme.
It does seem extreme. It
seems really extreme. Yeah,
very, like, it's probably, but it is funny because he's totally, you know, locked down. And then Billy Crudup comes in and he's like, I'm just so disappointed. But then he starts mouthing the words. And mm-hmm. earlier on, we established that Tom Cruise can read lips.
Yeah.
So he tells him, like, you got to go to Shanghai and you got to go to this room. And then he gives him like a, I don't know, some lock pick. And they're taking him up and he picks the lock.
Yeah.
Or a paper clip or whatever he gives him.
Yeah.
And he picks the lock. And I like this little fight scene that they have. Because it's pretty cool, well choreographed, because he has to take out like one hand and he beats up one guy and then he's got to take the other one and he's still got one foot in. So it's just kind of like a fun, it's always fun when you, in action scenes, when you can add things into the choreography that just kind of make things more difficult. You know, the props kind of add to the choreography of the scene. I thought this was a fun one.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's in this elevator and Ethan escapes from IMF and we find out that they're like headquartered in like the basement of like a post office or something, which is kind of fun.
I think it's the Department of Transportation, a DOT.
Which is fun. We've got a ticking clock. Davian gave him 48 hours, okay. Even when he gets detained, you're like, oh no, he doesn't have time for this, you know? Yeah. And I really like how by the time we get to Shanghai, and he's like where he gets his team together to get the rabbit's foot. Like by the time that they're planning, I love the scene when he's planning the fulcrum on the, on the wall. And I love, this is where you get the sense of like the grab and Tom Cruise's, this is another reason why MI3 is my favorite, is I feel like Tom Cruise's performance is just so great in this movie. I think he's such a great dramatic actor and I think it really shines in this movie.
Yeah.
And this scene where he's telling his team's, you know, telling him why they can't accomplish it and why it's crazy. And then he goes, it's 8:11, it's 8:12, and in 2 hours. And we learn we've got 2 hours left. That it's like, hey, we have to get into that building and get the rabbit's foot and get out and get it to Davian in 2 hours. Otherwise, Jules is dead and so am I. And
I do love him planning all this out and the dramatic acting that he does. The thing that I don't like about this scene, We'll get to the kind of the stunt of it in a minute. Mm. But the thing that I don't like about the scene is that they're like, they make this seem so hard and they're like, this makes Langley look like a cakewalk. And I'm like, and then they don't show it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why did you do that? Like,
they show the entrance, just say, the exit.
Yeah. Like, that's like, if Langley, you took so much time on this and you took so much time in the Vatican, which was great. Like, why did you make this the most elevated thing that you could in the series at that point and be like, and then just don't show it? Like, it's a small thing. I just wish they would have been like, listen, this is not going to be easy. You're going to have to do everything precise, but don't make it like this makes Langley look like a cakewalk and then just get in and then get out. And it's like, it's
here would be my argument is that it would just be. Is that the Vatican is our sequence in this movie to do that.
If
we were to do it twice in this film, it'd be like, we already did this. And I think that it's like, we know what it is. Like he's got to get through like a laser grid and he's got to get past like several guards and he's you know, like he's got to get past like a heat sensitive, like he's, you know, like I don't, whatever it is. Like we know that it's, we've seen the sequence and they already did it at the Vatican. And I think the thing about this movie that I like is that it's like, that's not really what's important to the plot of this movie. What's important is like, is Ethan going to get the thing in time?
And that's what makes me frustrated, is because they're setting it up to be the most important. Like, again, if this is harder than Langley,
right,
all you have to do is not say that line. Like, listen, this is going to be tough. You have to be exactly precise to get this on time. Don't set it up as if like, you've got to do this, 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 and this. Because you're setting that up, making me think, okay, I'm going to see this, 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 and this, and then they don't. Again, it's more in the delivery of the lines and like the script rather than like what they're saying. Like they could have just done it. I don't know. I'm like expecting to see this really cool sequence, and then we don't. So you just take out the line. I'm not necessarily mad.
Yeah. It is funny in this whole franchise how there always has to be a character who like comments on how crazy the thing they're about to do is,
sure,
even though they work for an agency called the Impossible Missions Force. So it's like, when like, you know, like in 4, when they're going into the Kremlin and Benji's like, I thought you said the Kremlin. And he's like, that's funny. I thought you said the Kremlin.
Yeah.
And then he just doesn't say it. But it's like, but Benji's like, we're going, I guess we're going to the Kremlin. But it's like, yeah, dude, like, what do you, who do you think you work for? Like,
yeah. Well, yeah. Who have you been working for the last few years?
There should be no mission that makes you go like, what? We're going to do what? But yeah, every movie.
That's impossible.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, we're the, like, impossible mission force.
Dead Reckoning part one, Benji's like, he's gonna jump off, he's gonna do what? It's like, yeah, of course he is. It's Ethan.
Well, yeah. And that is good, because later on in the series, he's like, I find it best not to worry. You know, Benji's like, I find it best not just to question, just he'll figure it out.
Yeah. But yeah.
But this is a small nitpick, not a big deal. The next part is the part that I love, that they really pumped this part on the marketing for this movie. He's on the top of some building. Mm-hmm. And we know he has got to jump off, and he's got to swing. And I mean, he's on. Do you know what they did for this stunt? Did he really jump off the top of this building?
No, it's awesome. Still, what they did, it's similar to what Florence Pugh did in Thunderbolts. Right. It's a big green screen warehouse, but he's still doing basically a bungee jump on a harness off of a 100-foot platform. And so they're still filming him with a green screen keyed out background, jumping off of a giant platform. He's still doing this bit, but it's just not in the city. And so, you know, he's still doing a big.
Yeah. Yeah. He's jumping off of a tall.
But they're not actually having him swing on a fulcrum off this building. What they did really do is the next stunt. So him jumping out, not him, like, you know, base jumping out of the window. The stunt that goes by so fast in this movie.
Yeah.
But it's so cool is cool. When he parachutes falls out of the building and he falls on the ground, and he and the truck slides over him. And they actually had a stunt driver figure out the mechanics of how to slide that truck they were like, right here is where Tom Cruise is going to be. And if you are off, you're going to run over Tom Cruise. And they begged him not to do it. They were like, please, we also don't need to do this. Like, we don't even need to have a stunt performer do this. Like, we can do this as a composite shot. We can just have you lie on the ground and just have like a VFX of a truck going over you. Like, it doesn't need to be.
Yeah.
And he insisted on doing it for real. And they actually had a diesel truck slide over him going full speed. And it's pretty cool. Yeah. But
That's crazy.
There's several fun stunts in this sequence. Yeah. Him sliding down the roof of the building. He actually did
that. Very cool.
Yeah. Very cool stunt. He gets the rabbit's foot. Again, what I like about this is that it's like the rabbit's foot's not what's important.
Right,
like,
right.
Like the mission impossibleness of it is not what's important. What's important is Ethan and Julia.
Yes.
And so he I like this too, that like he finally gets the phone call through to Davian, and Davian's like, you have 5 seconds. Do you understand that?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He gets the call. And then he gets in the back of some limo with the creepy British guy. And then he drinks the thing. He falls asleep and he wakes up, and we are at the first scene.
Right.
And like you said, as we've talked about, I wish it could have been the full scene. I do think it would have been better there.
Wouldn't it have been more powerful if after everything we've had happen, then we get this scene and we don't, you know. I think, though, what does still work is when we see the scene at the beginning of the movie, the first time we watch it, we don't know who the woman across from Ethan is.
Yeah.
We can tell that he's got an emotional attachment to her. Now that
he believes it's Julia.
Right.
Because he's like, yes.
What I'm saying is when we first see it, we don't even know who that is. Like the first time we watch the movie, we don't even know who that woman is.
Right.
We just can tell that Ethan really cares about her. And then when we get back to the scene, we're like, oh, it's Julia. And we know from kind of context clues from the beginning, like, oh, Owen's going to shoot her. And then he does. And Tom Cruise's performance here is
it's pretty crazy.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
His reaction to his wife getting shot in front of him is really, really powerful. And
I mean, he just doesn't say anything. And you just see it.
It's tears really just good. Pouring out of his eyes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I do like this reveal, Billy Crudup walking in. Revealing that he was the one behind it the whole time.
It's crazy because so the nice thing they do is they do let it play out, and you see the emotion on Tom Cruise's face, and you see that he feels like he has just lost his wife. And then they do this thing where you think you're looking at Tom Cruise, But then in the background, Philip Seymour Hoffman and the other guy are just kind of like sitting there and they're talking to someone. Mm-hmm. And then they walk away. And then all of a sudden you see Billy Crudup come in. And it's kind of like, whoa, what the? It is a good way to reveal this, you know, like it's kind of like, oh, and then he's like, the first thing he says is it's complicated.
It's complicated. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also like that we find out the reveal is it's not Julia. It was Owen Davian's head of security.
Yeah.
Who failed him at the Vatican. And so they put a mask on her of Julia to make sure that Ethan had really brought the rabbit's foot.
Yeah.
And
I do actually really like this whole reveal of like, they needed to make sure that it was a rabbit's foot. So they pretended to kill his wife. Like, it's actually like, wow, that's a very, very creative way of doing that whole scene. Like,
well, and it's also like the coldness of Owen Davian too.
Yeah.
Just to make sure that, you know, and like also like the way that he just toys with people, that he's like, yeah, to make sure that he actually brought us the real thing. Let's just dress my head of security up like his wife and I'll just tell him like, hey, that wasn't it.
Yeah.
So you have 10 seconds to tell me where the real one is. And if it's not the real one, he'll either crack or he won't. Yeah. And, you know, but I also think this is a really cool practical effect when Billy Crudup pulls the tape off of Julia's mouth and the mask rips and it kind of rips up the side and we see the other woman's face underneath. I think that's a really cool,
practical
effect.
And yeah. I think you talked about this last week and we didn't talk about it in the actual scene, but when Owen Davian is going and doing the counting one, you know, like, and he's going through and you see Tom Cruise going through like all the stages of grief. And like, he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. Right. And like,
He tries to lie
like the rabbit's foot is in Paris. He's like, it's not in Paris. Like, and again, he's just toying with him. Like, it's a great sequence that I love the back and forth between the
and
two.
And it's like, it sucks that where it actually comes chronologically in the movie, like where it actually lands, we cut away from it. We cut to the team getting back and Lawrence Fishburne detaining the team. And then we cut back to like, count seven right after he just shot her, you know. And but like, I love the in the fullness of the scene when he's just kind of like, hey, listen, whatever went wrong, I want to get you what you want, but you got to do what's right, you know.
And
it's such a strong scene from ten
shoots her. So
Tom Cruise, he gets confirmation that Julia is still alive and by pulling in cruddy crud up, little crud meister crud up. He pulls him. What a dork. He doesn't
realize.
What an idiot. He says, come over here so I can talk to her, gets him close, bites him on the hand, gets his pen out of his pocket and picks his lock. He gets out of there. And this is speaking of tech that changed the next year after this movie was released, there's a whole sequence here that I actually think is really fun, where Ethan calls Benji on the phone and says, Benji, I need you to trace the last call made from this phone and tell me where it is. And Benji's basically using like Google Maps to walk Ethan to the signal, but it didn't exist in 2006. And I'm watching this going like, oh yeah, like if this movie were made today, Benji could just send him an address or like a share my location. Like,
yeah, would, yeah.
He could just, you know, but like, it was, it's so interesting that it's like, this was like the last year that didn't exist, you know?
Yeah.
But I like this. Good. We have some really simple but effective practical stunt work from Tom Cruise, like him running across these rooftops and like, you know, doing like little parkour stuff. And then this sprint down
this has got to be the most prolonged sequence of Tom Cruise running in any film. He runs like a half a mile.
This is the ultimate Tom Cruise run. This run specifically where he does the straightaway down the river. Yep. They had a high-speed boat with a camera on it.
Oh, they did.
A stabilized camera following him.
Nice.
And it was like this whole thing where and I'm pretty sure they said it was like a quarter mile.
Yeah,
and he just
totally believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he is a very good runner. Yeah. He looks very good running on screen. And it's fun. It's very, very effective. But he goes like quarter of a mile, however long. And then he goes into this building. he has to kill a couple guys, but then he sees Julia and she's there and he's like, he gets her out. But then that's like when that's when the charge starts going and he is like, you can tell he's having a hard time.
And again, I talk about Tom Cruise's performance in this movie, and it's one of the reasons why I think it's one of his strongest performances in the franchise. And this is another moment where I'm like, boy, is he selling this for me? Yes. Like he's just, I just buy that there is something going off in his brain. He's so good at selling like the distress and the pain.
I think that's probably also why Carrie Russell is just because the way that he does it seems so much more effective.
Yeah.
And she barely has any time to do anything with it, but he really has a hard time even speaking and looking. Like it's hard for him almost to like open his eyes.
Yeah.
It seems so hard, but I love this fight scene because then Owen Davian comes in, Philip Seymour Hoffman comes in. And he's like, you've got about 4 minutes maybe, you know, or whatever.
Which again is so like action movie. It's like, surely you just have a detonator that you can just like
push the button.
Yeah. Just
like, Scotty. You just don't get it.
You just don't get it, do you? But also, it sort of fits with Owen Davian that he's like, I like to toy with people.
You know,
he talks about Carrie Russell. He's like, that was fun.
Yeah. You know?
And like the thing that he does with his head of security, we sort of established that Davian's like, well, I don't want to just kill you. Like, I kind of like to watch you suffer. Like,
yeah.
I'm certain you're going to die. And I told you, you know, I told you I was going to kill your wife in front of you. Maybe I'm going to kill you in front of her, actually, you know?
Yeah. But, and I love how... I mean, this shows how powerful Philip Seymour Hoffman is. I mean, he like actually has a hand-to-hand combat with Tom Cruise. Obviously, Tom Cruise is not at his best. He's got this thing going off in his head. But I love how he was like dragging him and Tom Cruise tries to get away and he just comes over and just like totally punches him in the face.
Yeah.
And I love how it all like plays out.
And well,
it's
again,
it's edited really well. Because he's basically at the worst point, and then he just has to like fight through it. But sorry,
and his character, Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, again just feels so in control.
Yes,
he just feels what's so scary about his character is how he just feels so like not worried and not bothered. Exactly. And I do think this is a little silly that Tom Cruise fights him Muay Thai style with his elbows.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, just because your head hurts doesn't mean you have to have your hands here. Cause he's not even touching his head. He's just holding his hands like this, like, oh, my head hurts. And then he's doing elbow hits. And I'm like, yeah, okay. Either be like, I have to hold my head because it actively is throbbing and do this, but he's literally going like this, like with his hand on the, you know, I'm like, okay, well, you could still, I'm sure you can make a fist still, but you know, it's kind of fun. He has to like push through the pain. And I love his performance here. He tackles Philip Seymour Hoffman out into the street. Philip Seymour Hoffman gets, it's like from Speed when what's his name in Speed? Dennis Hopper. It's basically that this truck comes by and just completely takes Philip Seymour Hoffman out.
And you see one little shoe like hit on the ground. I like that little thing.
Yeah, that's fun.
I do wish it was a little bit longer.
I know. We all just want more Hoffman in this movie.
We do.
We just want more of him. And it's a damn shame that we get so little of Owen Davian and of Philip Seymour Hoffman. I wish there were more films, honestly, as Philip Seymour Hoffman as like a villain character. Yes. He's so good in the movie The Master as kind of like a villainous guy. And he's, you know, he's just such a great actor. And it's too bad we don't have him anymore. But
exactly.
But again, Cruise is great here going back in and trying to explain to his wife what they need to do. This whole sequence when he's trying to explain to her what the gun is and how it works. And I'm just like, this is
point shoot.
You just slide it out and you just click it back in. And like you're putting like batteries in the flashlight.
In the remote. The
flashlight in the kitchen. And you know, and he explains to her how to use the Beretta and how to, and then he's like, you know, they don't have a defibrillator. So he's quickly putting together like I'm going to pour some water in this bowl and put some, you know, some wires in the bowl and I'm just going to electrocute myself. But like his whole performance, you feel that he's just like barely clinging to life as he's like he's got an active, the worst migraine imaginable.
Yeah.
And I really buy it. And I like this sequence. I love how he has her electrocute him and, I like the effect of him biting through the
Yes. Okay. So that's, I do like, he puts a, I don't know, some tongue depressors in his mouth. This has always been really, really funny to me.
Yeah.
Because he puts the tongue depressors in his mouth. He bites down. If you were to bite down, I don't think you can open your mouth.
Mm.
So like he bites down, but the pieces that he bit out just kind of like, they kind of like spit out of his mouth.
Yeah.
It looks so weird. I'm like, why did they like, did they feel that they had to like spit those out so he didn't choke on him? But it just looked.
Yeah, you'd think that because you'd think that the middle piece would be still in his mouth.
But they like, they like make it a point of like, you see it spit out.
Yeah.
Like it's weird. But anyway, love the scene. He is like, and then Julia has to, people actually show up and she actually has to kill some people. She kills one guy. The next guy that she kills is Billy Crudup. And he's like, he's like so surprised that he just falls over. And then the rabbit's foot comes out. You see it kind of roll out, which is a little kind of cool little final thing that, you know, and then she has to, you know, she does the love punch in the chest and it brings Tom Cruise back to life. Thank you.
I will say the first time I saw this movie in theaters, I genuinely was like, I could buy a version of this movie where he doesn't make it.
Yeah,
where, because it felt like the kind of capstone of the, again, it was like, we didn't know that there were going to be 8 Mission Impossible movies when this movie, it felt like this was going to be the end of, like, this is the end of Ethan Hunt's adventures. This is his last mission. He's going to get married. But like, I could see it being like that he sacrifices himself for her and that's like the end of his story, is that it's sort of tragic. And when I was watching it in theaters, I was like, oh, maybe they're going to do it. And she does bring him back. And he explains to her that he's part of IMF. And I do like that the movie kind of pokes fun at this, that he's like, I work for an agency called the Impossible Missions Force. And she's like, that can't be real. And he's like, I'm serious.
I'm serious. Actually, I did not know that was what the IMF stood for until I saw that movie.
Impossible Missions Force. Yep.
Great. IMF. Why would anyone name it an agency, the IMF? But
hey, when something's impossible and it can't be done, call the IMF.
There you go.
Yep. And basically, you know, we go back to Langley or whatever it is, the IMF headquarters, and we for some reason, now that they've accomplished their mission, they agree to let Julia. I don't know why Ethan accomplishing the mission means that they're like, yeah, bring your wife to work.
She knows.
Bring her on in here. You feel like he would still be like, we can't tell any of my friends that you know, because they'll kill you.
If
anyone finds out that you know, they'll kill you.
It's the Spider-Man problem. Yep. They'll come after you. But
right.
Which they do.
But I kind of do like the ending of this movie, because he's like, hey, what was the rabbit's foot? And Lawrence Fishburne goes, promise me you'll stay and I'll tell you. And then he just goes, all right. And he just leaves. And again, I think this is where the franchise could have reasonably had a really nice ending point. I like the movies that come afterward. I'm just saying, I think this would have been a really, this is a very like, and they lived happily ever after ending. And I'm just not sure that that's like what's meant for people like James Bond and Ethan Hunt, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But it is a good ending for this movie. It works.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and that's it. So let's get into our scores. On this podcast, we give ratings out of 10, 10 being the best, 1 being the worst. We give a technical rating for the craft of the film, how well it's crafted. We give a rating for the ending, how well we feel like they stuck the landing. A rating for rewatchability, a rating for the cultural significance of the film and impact of the film. And a rating for subjectivity. So Kramer, what is your technical rating for Mission Impossible 3?
My technical rating is 7.5. I think the big things are kind of those corny things that we've talked about. I also, you know, the cinematography in this is very early 2000s. You know, it came out in 2006. It's very teal and blue, and it's very saturated, as opposed to what we watched last week in Minority Report, which is a complete opposite.
Yeah.
But the cinematography in this, it looks good. It doesn't look bad. But I don't know if I love that look. And that kind of stood out to me. And, you know, there's a little things, again, kind of like with J.J. Abrams' direction. But overall, I mean, this is a great, it's a very well-made film. And especially if this is your first feature, that's a pretty amazing first feature to have.
Yeah. Mine's an 8.5. This is, I think, my every time I go through the mission movies, this is the one that I for some reason, really like. Yeah. It might just be the Philip Seymour Hoffman of it. It might just be Cruise's performance that I think it has the most emotional weight to it. It feels like the story that like matters the most to Ethan Hunt as a character.
Yeah.
And that seems to have the biggest impact going forward in the franchise. Mm-hmm. I feel like the things that I dock it for are maybe like a little bit of like that insecure opening scene where I'm like, man, I wish that would go later. And, you know, every once in a while, there are just lines in this franchise. Like there's a point in this movie where Tom Cruise runs up a wall at the Vatican and says, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. And I'm like, oh, I'm just like, oh, please, no, please don't. Yeah, please don't do that. Please don't do that to me. But, you know, that's kind of in all of these films. But I think, mm-hmm. I think this is a very well constructed film technically. And very well executed. How about for the ending?
The ending I gave an 8. I think the two biggest reasons are that wish we could have had the scene at the beginning in the proper place, and then I wish we could have had just a little bit more of a fight scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman. But overall, I mean, it's a pretty satisfying ending.
Yeah, I really love the ending of this movie. I mean, I kind of consider everything from like the building swing through, you know, him being like the final act of the film. And I think it all moves at a really nice pace and all has really high stakes and pays off really well and like resolves really well. And I think Cruise's performance through all of it is like really, really gripping and exciting. And so I gave it a 9.
Nice.
How about rewatchability?
Rewatchability, I gave an 8.5. It's a fun movie to rewatch. I probably should get, I don't know if I can say exactly why, but I think some of the little annoying things kind of get a little bit more annoying, but honestly, it's a very rewatchable film.
Yeah, I think that this is the movie I've rewatched more than any other in the Mission franchise. Yeah. And I coming back to it just recently, I probably hadn't seen it in 4 or 5 years, but I was like, man, it's still, I just, you know, I just enjoy it. So I give it a 9.
Nice.
It's always goes down smooth for me. Yeah. Cultural impact.
I'm giving an 8, and I don't know necessarily if that's completely for this movie, but this movie really did set off everything else. I mean, this was the one that really kind of made it like, okay, we're going to keep making these films. And as we have talked about, this really set the tone. So I think it's actually pretty significant. Maybe not the movie itself, but for what it did for the rest of the franchise. So I gave it an 8.
100%. I gave it a 9. Culturally, often this is a very hard score for us to give, especially with new films, because we don't really know. But this one, I think we actually can see that like the rest of this franchise, which is a big part of the film industry in the late 20th and early 21st century, it's one of the biggest franchises in the world.
Yes.
And in cinema, so much of the franchise was kind of influenced by this installment and kind of colored by this installment. And I definitely think that this, especially, you know, being like the last of this era before this sort of technological shift. And I think that there are a lot of elements to this that carried over, not just in the franchise, but in other movies too. So I give it a 9. Subjective score.
My subjective score is an 8. I do really, really like this one. It's definitely one of the better ones. Like I said, 6, Fallout is my favorite. Mm-hmm. But this one has a lot of great. This is definitely in the top for me. But yeah, I loved it.
I gave it a 9. It's my nice. I like it. Nice. If I had to do a ranking, I'd probably put Fallout either second or third behind the first one. I think the first one might go second for me because I like the uniqueness of that one too. But I great franchise. We're doing the new one next. We're doing Dead Reckoning or the Final Reckoning.
Don't get it wrong. It's not Dead Reckoning Part 2. It's the Final Reckoning.
The Final Reckoning. He's hanging off of a biplane. He's still at it. Tom Cruise is still getting after it. Go see it in theaters if you want to watch along with us for the next episode. That's what it will be. And that will kind of cap off our Tom Cruise a-thon.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and hey, I saw this movie today. I saw The Final Reckoning just right before we recorded. Go see this movie in the theater. Seriously. Yeah. It is worth it.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, and you're going to have to if you want to watch along with us.
Yeah, you will.
For next week's episode. So, okay, we will see you then.